This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Powered by U Mobile. 5G now with you.
Good morning. You're listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar. Prime Minister Dato' Sri Anwar Ibrahim has made reforms the cornerstone of the government agenda. Hence, the law and institutional reform portfolio under the Prime Minister's department takes outsized importance in pursuing legislative change. One major reform currently on the table is the abolishment of the mandatory death penalty, which currently applies for 11 offences under the law. But overall, is the progress of reforms being held back by political considerations? Joining me today to talk more about the reform agenda, including ending mandatory capital punishment, is YB Ramkarpal Singh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department for Law and Institutional Reform. He is also the Member of Parliament for Bukit Gelugo. Ram, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Now, you have been an outspoken backbencher in Parliament during your first two terms as MP. And as they say, the third time's the charm. You're now a deputy minister in the present cabinet. You're in the driver's seat of government policy. Is it different being on the front bench?
Well, certainly there are differences. As a backbencher, I think you have certain freedoms to express yourself in Parliament, not only in Parliament but also outside Parliament. But as a front bencher, I think you have to also consider the government policy, and you have to be consistent with that. And of course, concentrate on your portfolio. And there's quite a lot of things to do. So it's also a learning process for me.
Okay.
Being a front bencher for the first time.
So there are definitely constraints in terms of what you can say and what you can't say, and you're feeling that.
Certainly, I think that is part of ministerial responsibility, and I think it's, like I say, you know, it's a learning process for me as well.
I want to talk about the current government setup, and I think it caught a lot of people by surprise in a way, because previously I think there wasn't any love lost between DAP and UMNO, no love lost between Barisan Nasional and Pakatan Harapan. You've even previously mocked the cooperation between UMNO and PAS as a marriage of convenience. What would you say about the present Pakatan Harapan Barisan Nasional alliance? Is it different from an UMNO-PAS Muafakat Nasional type of thing?
I think certainly there are very clear differences between that coalition and this unity government. This unity government, I think we have to make it very clear that we have certain objectives in mind, objectives which have been agreed upon before its formation. And the main objective is to sort of revive the economy, restore what has been lost over the years in terms of the progress of the country. And this requires, I think, a collaboration and also sort of a compromise between these two sort of parties who have had very different ideologies in the past. And so with that, those things in mind, those considerations in mind, I think given the current political climate in this country, I think it's important to look towards the future for the betterment of the country, its people, and hopefully we can achieve reforms, and we'll see a better Malaysia in 5 years from now.
Okay, so you're saying that two sides that were previously on opposing ends, they're come together driven by a common goal, and that is the betterment of the nation.
Certainly, yes.
In the past, you haven't pulled your punches when it comes to sparring with UMNO MPs, but today you find yourself as one of the few DAP MPs that's working directly with an UMNO member. Your minister is Dato' Sri Azalina Othman, you're her deputy. Has it been difficult for you to shift mindset from viewing UMNO as the opposition and now as an ally?
Well, I've had no issues working with Azlina. I have in the past, in fact, when even before the unity government was formed, We work together on the IPCMC select committee. She was a member of that committee as well. I chaired it, and so we have had a working relationship in the past. So I have had no difficulty working with her now as well. I'm sorry, what was the second part of your question?
Well, that was really it. I wanted to get your thoughts on how that worked. But one thing that I did find striking was public reception to the pairing of you and Azalina. I think there was a lot of people were quite receptive to this. There wasn't the baggage that would come with UMNO and DAP coming together. I mean, why do you think the public so readily accepted this? Does this say something about, I suppose, how you and Azalina are perceived as MPs?
Well, I think it has to do also with our legal background. We share that in common. And so our ministry being obviously to do with the law, its reform and institutional reform, I think this has gone down well with the public. I mean, we at least we have some headway in this field. So I think perhaps that might have contributed to public perception of our partnership.
How are responsibilities divided between you and Azalina in this portfolio? Do you work on things together, or do you focus on separate issues that under this portfolio?
Well, I mean, of course, we work together on various issues, but broadly speaking, there is an understanding that our tasks are divided into two main areas. One is criminal justice reform. The other is obviously matters more towards the civil side of things. I look into the criminal justice reform aspect. She looks at the other. And of course, there are many overlapping, a lot of times these two broad categories would overlap. And so we work together, with this in mind.
Okay, let's turn to policy matters. And we're going to talk about the abolishment of the mandatory death penalty in a little bit. But I do want to get that big picture view in terms of what the government's reform priorities are. So how would you elucidate what the reform agenda is?
Well, I mean, reform is a very... it's a very broad sort of aspect, you know, that we have to look at. When we talk about reform, I think we have to open our minds to different points of views. And in our case, reform comprises of many aspects. And the government has always kept an open mind. I think that's important to note. We are very willing to listen to stakeholders, to those who have an interest in the particular fields of reform that we are looking at, to see, you know, how they can contribute and give us ideas as to how to the way forward. And I'm quite happy to say that I've only been in this line for about 3 months, but in that short time. We have had occasion to have met many stakeholders who have, given us fresh ideas. And I think this is what the government wants, you know, in terms of reform. We want to hear from people. We want to know what their views are so that we can implement them if they are found to be suitable.
Okay, so engagement is a key approach in how you tackle these reforms. I'm wondering if there's like a list of reforms that you're working towards, perhaps, because we've seen just in this past 100 days, there's been movement on citizenship, and we see other reforms coming onto the table, like the mandatory death penalty abolishment. But I guess more broadly, do you have specific targets or areas that you're focusing attention on?
Well, of course, we have identified various areas which we are looking at to reform. The death penalty is one, as you know. It's coming up very soon. Citizenship laws have also, attracted considerable criticism of late, and that also has been looked at. Azlina, I think, has made a few announcements recently on this, and we'll be looking very much at amending certain laws, the constitution, in fact, to achieve this. Other aspects of reform include the Freedom of Information Bill, or the Act that we intend to introduce, the Whistleblowers Act, and so on. So the list is, I mean, that's just a few of quite of many, and we are looking. Of course, this is going to be to increase as time goes by. As far as prison reform is something which is very important as well, because that is something to do with the criminal justice system. I'm looking into that personally. I hope to get some headway in terms of prison reform in the near future. So these are all these are matters which these problems have been around for a long time, and I think the time has come to at least address them and find solutions, hopefully.
Okay. Help me understand how much autonomy you have under the law and institutional reforms portfolio to determine what reforms to pursue. Okay, I'm going to take an example, something like SOSMA amendments. This is being implemented by the Ministry of Home Affairs more broadly. But whose call is it then to, I suppose, push forward these amendments? Does it come from your ministry or your agency, or does it come from the Home Affairs Ministry?
Well, of course, in generally speaking, most statutes or legislation have what we call carrier ministries. So in the case of SOSMA, the ministry which carries that particular legislation is the Ministry of Home Affairs. So any initiation towards reform in respect of SOSMA ought to and should come from the Home Ministry. Of course, we facilitate the process by assisting the Home Ministry in partaking in engagement exercises with various stakeholders and so on, which you know, they also have a part to play in, such as the PDRM, KDN, and so on. So we have to work with these parties, get their views on SOSMA. I'm talking particularly about SOSMA now.
Yes.
So that, so in other words, what I'm saying is that we work in tandem. We work together. You know, when it comes to
what are the areas that
things.
What are the areas that you're that you are that you call the shots on, if I can ask?
Oh, we under my ministry.
Yes.
You mean? Oh, under my ministry, we have various fields which we call, well, I wouldn't say we call the shots on, but we
have you're the carrier ministry, I
suppose.
Yeah,
of course, you know, when we talk about judicial reform, when it comes to the courts.
Would Parliament also be under
Parliament,
your purview?
These are under us.
Okay.
So we can initiate, you know, talks towards reform.
Okay. I'm speaking to Ramkarpal Singh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department and MP for Bukit Gelugor. When we come back, we'll discuss in depth some of the reforms in the pipeline. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile. 5G now with you.
Thanks for staying tuned to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mokhtar, and with me today on the show is Ramkarpal Singh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department for Law and Institutional Reforms. So earlier, Ram, I was trying to get a sense of your purview in terms of what you oversee under this portfolio. I want to focus on specific reform initiatives at the moment. So let us start off with the decision to abolish the mandatory death penalty. This is something that the government is continuing from the previous administration. Something that Pakatan Harapan has championed from the very beginning since 2018. It's been lauded by activists and the international community alike. But why not abolish the death penalty in totality? Why limit it to just the mandatory death penalty? Why is this arguably cruel and inhumane form of punishment being maintained in our statute books?
Well, I think you are absolutely right in saying that, you know, the abolition is something that ought to be considered, perhaps, because I think many countries in the world have moved towards that direction. Ours is a partial abolition, which is just the mandatory part of the death penalty. I think the reason for that is that at this stage, perhaps, I think we need to educate the public a bit more as to why it ought, perhaps, in the future, it might, it ought to perhaps be a total abolition. But at this stage, perhaps, we are not ready for it at this stage. But I think it's the, a start would be abolishing it partially, the mandatory part at least. So,
when you say we're not ready for it, in what ways are we not ready for it? Is this coming from, I suppose, the public, or is it coming from political figures? Where is the pushback towards an abolition of the death penalty coming from?
Well, I mean, of course, there are many people or parties who are pro-total abolition, and we have heard them, and I think they have given us very good, compelling views. And certainly, like I said, it is something which is not has not been excluded, something which we will consider in the next stages of this issue. But at this stage, I think we have focused on the mandatory part. And like you said, pointed out correctly earlier, this is an initiative that that began in the earlier PH rule in 2018. Of course, there's been quite a lot of fine-tuning in between until now. And so I think we are now ready to present that bill in Parliament.
The government is expected to table a series of amendment bills this month, or is it just one bill? Can you walk me through, I guess, what the legal process is to abolish the mandatory death penalty across the 11 offences that it currently applies?
Well, at this point of time, there are 11 offences which prescribe or carry the mandatory death penalty. What that means is that in these cases, a judge only has one option. If he were to convict an accused person, which is to sentence him to death. And so in these offences, the abolishment will mean that the judge still retains the discretion to impose the death penalty, although he has the option of imposing a jail sentence. So now at this stage, where we are at is that we have amended all the laws or statutes which prescribe the death penalty, either mandatory or not, to reflect the abolishment of the mandatory part of it. So we will be tabling it. There'll be various readings, various stages.
So it's more than one bill.
Yes, it's more than one bill. It's each individual bills which carry those sentences to make that change. Yes.
Do you foresee any challenges to passing these amendments, and how soon do you think these laws can take effect?
Well, I don't think, I mean, we are ready to table them, in fact, as soon as this week. And there'll be three main stages in the Dewan Rakyat. And I think that could conclude by early April. And then there's the, it has to be brought to the Dewan Negara, the Senate. And then we have to receive the royal assent, and then it
so
has
we're looking
to be
at a timeline of the first half of the year, second half of the year.
Oh no, I think in about perhaps 2 months, 2 to 3 months.
Okay, then we'll see those amendments on the statute books, and it will immediately.
Then it will come into effect once it's properly gazetted.
Okay.
Yes.
I want to come to the issue of judicial discretion in sentencing. So you said the abolishment of the mandatory death penalty will give judges the option of whether to impose a death penalty sentence or not. So there will be alternatives. Judges can exercise that. But I think if we look at amendments that were made in 2017 to the Dangerous Drugs Act, where judges were given that discretion for certain drug trafficking offenses, it wasn't really considered consistently applied. And there seemed to be a lot of confusion with regards to the interpretation of the law and how it should be implemented. So I suppose, is this something that your ministry is cognizant of? And how are you going to address these issues with these latest round of amendments that apply to so many different acts?
Current amendments would completely remove the death penalty, or the mandatory part of it at least. So once that is done, it is completely in the hands of the court in terms of sentence. The court can maintain the death sentence. It has that option, or it can replace it with a lesser sentence of imprisonment. So it's in the hands of the courts.
Which, to me, just gives more power to judges then, right, to determine the fate of somebody in the dock. I suppose, how will judges be prepared to mete out that kind of sentence? You know, how will they consider which option to choose in deciding the fate of somebody there?
Well, I think, judges are experienced, especially when it comes to death penalty cases, it's only reserved for the High Court and above. So these judges have experience in meting out sentences in these kind of cases. Of course, they would be guided by past precedents when it comes to sentencing. Every case is unique in its own way. You know, it presents its own facts and circumstances. So the courts will have to consider each case on its own merits to decide whether or not a lesser sentence is appropriate.
So Malaysia has had a moratorium on execution since 2018. Mm-hmm. How soon will this moratorium be lifted once these amendments go through? And what does that mean for the 840 prisoners who are directly impacted by this, meaning that they have exhausted their appeals process and they're really just waiting for their sentence to be carried out?
Well, those I think there are various categories of persons who are affected. One are those whose trials are still pending or appeals are still pending. They would directly the law would directly apply to them, meaning that since the judicial process has not come to an end, when the new law comes into effect, it will apply retrospectively, meaning that even if the offence was committed years ago, but it's still in the trial or appeal process, then the court will implement the new law on them. Mm-hmm. But for those whose appeal process or judicial process have come to an end, there will be a review process where they would be they'll be at liberty to file an application back to the federal court for the federal court to review their death sentence to see whether or not it is an appropriate case to be reduced.
Okay. Many of the offences will carry the punishment of imprisonment for natural life in lieu of the mandatory death penalty. That's what I understand. I mean, can our already overcrowded prisons house more inmates for longer periods of time if they're sentenced to life imprisonment? I don't see how this would reduce the burden on our prison system at the moment.
Before I answer the question, I think natural life is also going to be removed. Natural life at this meant quite a few offences carry natural life. What that means is that a person would be in prison until he passes away. That will also be removed to put a cap on life imprisonment. Mm-hmm. So we are discussing the that particular cap. So it's no longer, one of our policy decisions is to do away with natural life.
Okay.
Yes, so that's another part of this area of reform.
Ramkapal, hold that thought. We are heading into the 8:30 a.m. news bulletin, but we'll continue this discussion after that. I'm speaking to Ramkapal Singh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department and MP for Bukit Galugur on The Breakfast Grill. We'll continue the conversation after the 8:30 a.m. news bulletin in this extended edition. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
You are listening to The Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile. 5G now with you.
BFM 89.9, you're listening to an extended edition of The Breakfast Grill. I'm Shazana Mukhtar, and with me today is Ram Karpal Singh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department for Law and Institutional Reforms. Earlier on the show, before the news bulletin, we were discussing a little bit of the intricacies that occur as we move towards the abolishment of the mandatory death penalty. I think one thing we were stuck on earlier, Ram, was about the removal of the sentence of imprisonment for natural life. That's no longer going to be on the books with the mandatory abolishment. Could you talk us through what is the alternative then? What's going to replace that?
Well, it'll be a prison, obviously a prison sentence of a certain period, which there'll be a cap of what that period would be. And this will be, of course, discussed and debated in Parliament in the coming week or so when it's debated.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's no longer a case where a person dies in Parliament. I'm so sorry. dies in prison.
Freudian slip there. I suppose Parliament can be quite the chore.
Yeah, it is quite challenging. But so it's no longer a situation where the person dies in prison.
I see.
Yes. So there will be a cap.
Okay. Earlier, you were saying something about how abolishing the mandatory death penalty will help to alleviate congestion in prisons. Can you just walk me through a little bit how that's so? Because though there's still a cap, to me, it sounds like there'll just be more people in prison.
Well, I mean, there are people on death row now. And that, like you noted earlier, there's a moratorium in place. So they're not being executed at this point of time, and they have not been for a while. So a number of them would be, released in the event the court replaces their death sentence with a term of imprisonment, because quite a few of them have been in prison for many years. So normally how it works is the courts will deduct a certain amount of period of time from their actual prison sentence. And I would imagine that a number of them would be eligible or entitled to be released in the event their sentences of death are replaced with imprisonment in the near future. So that would, I suppose, ease prison congestion to a certain extent.
Ram, one of the issues with the death penalty in Malaysia is the fact that it applies actually to a number of offences that are seen as not crimes of a huge magnitude, yeah? The fact that it applies to drug trafficking offences, it ensnares those who have very small amounts of drugs in their possession. A lot of people feel that this is disproportionate punishment. Will the abolishment of the mandatory death penalty still have that kind of punishment for these crimes?
Of course, I completely agree what you just said. I think every sentence, the principle of proportionality must be at the forefront when it comes to sentencing. So at this point of time, a person can be presumed to be a drug trafficker, if he has more than 15 grams of heroin in his possession, compared to someone who has, say, 500 grams. They both face the same fate. So that's obviously not proportionate. So when we introduce this new law, the court can take into account that fact, the amount of drugs and so on, in considering whether or not he should face the death penalty compared to someone who has a larger amount of drugs on him, as an example. But as far as sentencing is concerned, I think another very important factor is the rehabilitative part of prisoners. I think it's very important to consider, because all sentencing exercises would take into account rehabilitation.
Mm-hmm.
So, when we sentence somebody, we should also bear in mind, his rehabilitative process. Of course, if you were to execute someone, the question of his rehabilitation and entering into society again in the future doesn't arise.
Right.
Right. So, this was also a very important factor and consideration taken into account.
Okay. The idea of rehabilitative justice sounds great in theory, but what are the challenges in transitioning from a punitive to a rehabilitative approach? Because I feel like the urge for punishment is a lot stronger than the urge to rehabilitate sometimes.
Well, I think, there's so many things to look at. Many crimes are committed at the spur of the moment, by young people, those who later come to regret their actions in the long term. So, you know, when we look at the statistics and look into why these offences are committed, if we were to talk about drug trafficking, for example, you find a lot of the offenders are what we call drug mules. You know, those are what we call the little fish, you know, who are employed by the big fish to go to sell drugs on the streets. Now, if you were to execute them, sentence them to death, you're not really addressing the problem of drug trafficking, which is a major problem, no doubt about that. Mm. And so, you know, I think when we talk about coming to of rehabilitation, we have to look at these humanitarian aspects as well.
Okay.
I think we cannot lose sight of these realities.
Okay, so it's a real, but it's going to be a big shift, right? It's supposed to, it should be across all society in terms of the those working in the system as well as the public outside of it.
I think so, yes.
Okay, we don't have much time left on the clock, Ram, but I do want to just maybe get some updates on other reforms on the table, like what you're currently working on. Let's do a rapid fire round. I'll ask you about a particular legislative reform that you've spoken about in the past, and maybe you can give us a quick status update. SOSMA amendments, I want to start there. What's the progress of stakeholder engagement?
We have already started the process. We have met with various stakeholders. We've met with PDRM. We've met with various NGOs, lawyers, who are practicing in this field. So, of course, we've got many more engagement rounds to go. We hope to complete them in the near future, within the next few months, and come up with recommendations as to how this law can be, you know, improved, perhaps.
Does it personally pain you, Ram, given that you've spoken out against SOSMA in the past? Mm. You've spoken for it to be abolished or amended, but that's not happening at the pace that was initially desired.
Yes.
I mean, is that something that is, I guess, causes pain for you?
I don't think it causes pain, but it can be a bit of a disappointment. But because I was in practice before. As a criminal lawyer mainly, and I used to do quite a number of SOSMA-related cases. So I have seen how it can be, how there are weaknesses in SOSMA which need to be improved or addressed at least. So I think it's important to discuss this with all those, even those who are pro-SOSMA, to perhaps get their points of view, perhaps, you know, give our points of view to them so that we can find solutions. Because I believe SOSMA requires or needs to be addressed, and solutions need to be found.
Okay. What about efforts to decriminalize suicide? What's the progress on that? Are we moving along on this? Because this is also something that you've spoken about.
Oh, yes. Currently, attempted suicide is an offence. We are looking towards decriminalizing that offense. In other words, taking it away, doing away with that offense. I think when we talk about attempted suicide, there's a lot of things to consider, particularly, you know, the mental health of a person who attempts suicide. And so it's very, it's not only confined to it being a criminal issue. I think it's also very much a medical issue, which requires, and we have engaged with the health ministry and so on, mm-hmm. on this to see how best we can improve various statutes and legislation, such as the Mental Health Act, to accommodate those who are, you know, depressed and so on, who consider taking their lives. Mm. And so certainly we will be abolishing the crime of attempted suicide.
Okay, so that's something in the future to look at. You've spoken in the past about abolishing the Sedition Act, albeit in a previous role as the backbencher. Is this at all on the cards?
Not at this point of time, but it's something that perhaps we will. It's not, we have not excluded that possibility, but something perhaps further down in the pipeline.
Okay. And how soon can we see a Freedom of Information Bill being tabled?
I think perhaps towards the end of this year.
Okay. All right. So there's a timeline in that sense. We can see, we may see something on the cards by the end of the year. Ram, in the little bit of time that we have, the country is scheduled to go to state elections in six states later in the year, in June. Yeah. What I want to ask is, are state elections a reason for putting the brakes on reform progress at the moment? So we have received, I guess, viewpoints from observers that say the government is not moving fast enough on reforms because of political considerations due to state elections. Mm. How much will the state elections impact what the reform agenda of the government is?
No, I think state elections is, of course, it's inevitable. It's coming to, as you said, around June, July. But I think reform should not be halted because of the state elections. Certainly, what we are looking to implement. In fact, reforms can sort of be good for state elections in the sense that people might be happy that there are progressive, initiatives taken by this current government, and it could augur well for them in the state elections as well.
Ram, there's never enough time to cover everything that we want, but thank you so much for coming to studio and taking time to speak to us today.
Thank you.
I've been speaking to YB Ramkarpal Singh, Deputy Minister in the Prime Minister's Department and MP for Bukit Galugor. This has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9.
The BFM Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. 5G now with you.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.